This Civic Media podcast is sponsored by UW Organ and Tissue Donation. Organ donations are desperately needed, and now is the right time to become an organ donor. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. Go to heroicdeed.com. The Patriotic Millionaires also purchase advertising time on various Civic Media stations throughout Wisconsin.
Time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy, money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires. Now, let's start talking money.
What's up, Wisconsin and beyond? I'm Maggie Dawn, host of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Every day at 3 o'clock, we talk about money in a segment that we call Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Today, our very special guest is Peter Goodman. He is the economics correspondent, the global economics correspondent for the New York Times, the author of Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World. And his newest book is How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. So today on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, we're going global. We're going to talk about the global supply chain, which is this complex system that gets you everything that you need, from factories to farms to cell phones, you name it. It's probably impacted by the global supply chain. So my big hearty welcome to Peter. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Very excited to talk about this. Can you tell us what the book is about and what got you thinking, oh, gee, I want to write a whole book about the global supply chain?
I never thought I would want to write a whole book about the global supply chain. It seemed just wonky and maybe even boring, although it turns out it's fascinating. But, you know, it kind of got thrust upon me. I was living in London for the first wave of the pandemic, and we had a baby born on April 8th, 2020, and my wife was pretty stoic about the fact that her parents couldn't fly over from New York to help out, and we had cooped up school-age kids destroying our, you know, blissful vision of shared parental leave time. But where she lost it is we got home from the hospital, and we couldn't find hand sanitizer. We couldn't find masks. And then we went online. We tried to order the ingredients to make hand sanitizer. We couldn't find those either. And she looked at me and she said, "You're supposed to know, you know, how this stuff works. What's going on here?" And I realized that at first I didn't have a satisfying answer to that question. And once I really got into it, it was really kind of the breakdown of the sort of globalization that we've all gotten accustomed to over decades. And as I started to write a bunch of stories for the Times about the breakdown of the supply chain, which was, you know, shipping was overwhelmed. Factories in China were overwhelmed with orders. In the States and in the UK, where I still was, we supposedly had run out of truck drivers. We didn't have enough warehouse workers. And as I got into the minutiae and figured out that it was actually pretty fascinating, I realized that it required book length to explain how this vital system broke down in our darkest hour of need.
Well, first of all, congrats on the birth of your child.
Thank you.
Over 4 years ago. And boy, that's quite a honey do list, Peter. Dear honey, please fix the supply chain so I may have some hand sanitizer with my newborn. Well, you're working on it, right? Though we do not have time to dissect your book in these brief segments here, most of us, probably, unless we went to business school or were an economist or did some wonky thing ourselves, probably didn't even hear about the supply chain, let alone the global supply chain, until COVID-19. So, you know, what is it that somebody listening at home, that and most of our folks are here in Wisconsin, if you're talking to a regular Wisconsinite, what is the couple most important things about the supply chain that you think a regular person, all you out there, need to know as we move forward past COVID? Are we only susceptible if another, you know, 100-year plague descends upon us?
No, we are definitely susceptible. There will be another shock. We don't know what it will be, but it will happen because that's how life works. It's inevitable. And it will, again, test and probably expose the deficiencies and the vulnerabilities in the supply chain. You know, look, it's sort of like the electrical grid, right? We're invited not to think about it. We don't think about power stations and giant wires. We just flip on the switch, the lights go on. Well, if the lights don't go on for millions of people in the middle of an emergency, then we do start thinking, what's going on there? Who's paying attention to this? How did this happen? Who's benefiting from the state of play that made us vulnerable to power outages? And, you know, when we can't make a ventilator in the middle of a pandemic, when we don't have PPE for frontline medical workers, when we run out of, you know, things that aren't so life and death, exercise bikes are late when we can't go to the gym in the middle of a pandemic, when today we can't build enough affordable housing in part because the supply chain can't produce enough, you know, meters to measure water and gas. That's a serious problem that bears reckoning with. Now, you're asked quickly, like, what's going on here? Here's what's going on in the quick version. We have normalized the exploitation of the unseen army of people we're depending on to make our stuff and deliver it to our doors. There are truck drivers, warehouse workers. There are people in factories in our own country, around the world, who are essentially unable to attend to their own families at anything close to a middle-class standard. Their time doesn't belong to them. You know, it's a just-in-time supply chain for companies where they're very lean with inventory and warehouses because they'd rather save the capital they might spend putting, you know, extra parts and extra products in warehouses as a hedge against trouble. They'd rather give it to corporate executives as a reward for going so just in time. Well, for the people who actually do the work, who deliver products through trucks and work in warehouses, their own time is treated as sort of unlimited and without any value. And every time there is a shock, and especially when unemployment's low and people get to contemplate, maybe there's something else out there for me, turns out we run out of workers. These worker shortages are really the story of downgrading jobs to the point at which we run out of people willing to do them. And then we can talk about this in greater detail, but financialization and the paramountcy of shareholder interests, which if, you know, this is beyond just the supply chain, this is American life in general, and much of the wealthy world, where the interests of the investor class trump all other interests. And that's a big part of the explanation for how we ran out of so much stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because back in B school, when I was there many decades ago now, you know, just-in-time supply chain management was sort of, ooh, it's this cool thing. See how low you can keep your inventory costs. And this is this, especially as AI rises in prominence, there's all sorts of applications when you think about it from a supply chain perspective. But I wanted to emphasize, your first point was, it is the normalization of the exploitation of labor is what we're talking about.
That's right.
About the people that help bring products to us. You know, we saw the longshoremen, of course, on the Eastern Seaboard. They had to strike. We've observed on this show that the port companies had exploding profits that have continued to rise coming out of COVID, some 800% rise in profits. The workers that make all that possible saying, hey, can we eat too at this table? And of course, the primacy of shareholder interest. Who's benefiting? I mean, is it the shareholders or is it a particular group of shareholders? Is it the CEOs or is it sort of all of the above?
It's all of the above. It's consumers to some extent. I mean, this sort of supply chain has been thrust upon us, kind of optimizing conditions for big box retailers like Target and Walmart and now giant e-commerce players like Amazon. And the deal has always been like, look the other way on the fact that we're exploiting lots of warehouse workers and truck drivers and tapping overseas supply chains where human rights are not, you know, part of the equation, where workers can't organize, because we're going to hook you up with low-cost products. And in exchange, you will also look away from or not be aware of the fact that most of the benefits of this mode of operation are going to the investor class. They're going to corporate executives who are paid in stock, who are interested in making share prices go up every quarter. But, you know, there's also this idea that we can either have a really efficient supply chain or we can have a more resilient supply chain, as if these things are in opposition. You know, I just want to go back to your point about just-in-time, which was a great idea. Very sensible idea. This is how Toyota was organized. You know, instead of wasting lots of raw materials, run your supply chain the way a grocery store manages milk. You know, you want enough on the shelf that everybody can come in and buy milk if they want it, but not so much that you're spilling milk because it's gone bad. Well, Toyota actually did that. It worked great, but along come consultancies like McKinsey who invite companies to overdo it. Tap faraway supply chain, something Toyota never would have done, and then just, you know, hand the rewards of low prices and not much inventory to corporate CEOs as a reward for being smart enough to hire the likes of McKinsey. And where does this come down for the rest of us? Well, it turns out it's not really all that efficient. I mean, in the book, I tell the story of how the railroads did their version of just-in-time called precision scheduled railroading. I talked to an engineer for Union Pacific Railroads out in Idaho who was horrified to discover that he was actually pulling cargo to the wrong destination because Union Pacific was so intent on showing Wall Street, look, we did it. We lowered dwell time, this metric that measures, you know, how long does cargo sit in any particular place. If you lower that number, that's supposed to be a marker of efficiency. Well, some guy running the Union Pacific rail yard in Nebraska says, I don't care where the next train's going. I'm attaching as many cars to it as possible so I can lower dwell time. Meanwhile, somebody in Southern California is waiting for a car part they need that is going to Oregon instead, and it's going to take weeks to get back to them. And so it goes. That's not efficient. That's only good if all you care about is a metric that'll make share prices go up in the next quarter.
Yeah, and help CEOs reap exorbitant pay that is some thousand times greater than the average median income of their frontline workers. Folks, that's Peter Goodman. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent. He's written two incredible books. Today, we're talking about his newest book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Peter, we talked about, and you mentioned, these two objectives when you think of the supply chain. You want a resilient supply chain and an efficient supply chain. It's often talked about as if you can only do one but not the other. Is that a myth?
Yeah, it's absolutely a myth. I mean, first of all, there's inefficiency in lack of resilience, because if your stuff is supposed to be in Oregon and instead it's on a train going to Southern California, that's neither resilient nor efficient, right? And that's what we get if we just cater to the metrics that are making share prices go up on Wall Street. But also, you know, if you want the UPS guy or the Amazon guy to show up at your door, you better think about that person's ability to, you know, deal with their children, their sick relative, to have a life outside of work so that they won't just quit when some other option comes along.
Yeah, I often think of that as they're dropping things off at 9:30 at night. My goodness. Folks, we'll be back with more with Peter Goodman, New York Times global economics correspondent, on today's episode of Maggie and the Millionaires, talking money here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Keep it locked.
You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
Time for a deep dive into the one issue that matters most in a capitalist democracy: money. This is Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money, a joint production of the Maggie Dawn Show and the Patriotic Millionaires. Now, let's start talking money.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name's Maggie Dawn. I'm host of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Every 3 o'clock hour, we do a little segment called Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. Today, we're talking about the global supply chain with my very special guest, Peter Goodman. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent and the author of a new book called How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Peter, before we went to the break, we were talking about the fact that workers seem to bear the brunt of the burden of producing this efficiency in the supply chain and the profit that inures to the benefit of shareholders and CEOs. especially in modern day CEO pay, where it's mostly stock-based compensation. Just today, news came out that at one of the companies located in North Carolina, six workers died, allegedly because their CEO would not allow them to leave the manufacturing floor as the floodwaters were rising. This is an extreme example.
Yeah.
But is it really? Because during the time of COVID, we looked to workers to keep these goods moving at great potential risk to themselves and their families. These were the essential workers that kept our economy right, at least hanging on by a thread. How much are working people suffering? Are these unusual circumstances, or is this a regular thing where the workers that create these supply chain efficiencies are really the ones that bear the burden?
I mean, that's an extreme example, but it's certainly representative of the fact that, you know, I don't know who the CEO of that company is, but if that company's publicly traded, they're answerable to a board and to a broader investor class that's demanding the lowest possible costs, the greatest possible revenues, and any deviation, you know, even if the answer is, well, I was trying to do right by my employees, is an invitation to go, you know, look for their next job. I mean, in my book, I tell the story of a woman who was working at a slaughterhouse in Greeley, Colorado. This is a slaughterhouse run by JBS Foods, which is the world's largest meat packer, run by a couple of Brazilian brothers who literally spent time in prison for amassing through fraudulent means the credit needed to roll up lots of slaughterhouses, including in the United States. And this woman, Tin Ai, who was a refugee from Myanmar, her daughter was begging her not to go to this plant. It was early in the pandemic. It seemed like a potential super spreader situation. And the Trump administration had actually dropped an executive order calling workers in slaughterhouses essential workers. Now, this part of the story is probably familiar to people. Here's the part that wasn't familiar to anybody until we got hold of some documents that I lay out in the book. At the time that the Trump administration parroted the industry talking points to say, if women like Tin Ai don't keep laboring in dangerous conditions in these slaughterhouses, we are going to go hungry. The meatpacking industry was literally sitting on record volumes of frozen products, were exporting those products around the world. So basically, Tin Ai, who unfortunately was one of four workers who died in the first wave of the pandemic at this slaughterhouse, and I heard this story from her daughter cradling her then 18-month-old baby, looking at a picture of the grandmother, you know, he would never meet. She lost her life not to feed us, but to funnel monopoly profits to JBS Foods, one of four companies that controls 85% of the American beef supply. There's a lot of these sorts of stories in what we can call the supply chain of the American economy writ large. People are sacrificing supposedly for the benefit of consumers. Usually it's for the investor class.
Yeah, that's an incredibly poignant example. We know for as well that very recently one of the two or three egg producers in the United States, they actually, one, culled the herd to keep egg prices artificially high, and then actually shipped eggs out of the United States to somewhere else, again, right, effectively engaging in price gouging and price manipulation. Same situation there, and that poor woman gave her life for it.
Right.
How do we make the supply chain more resilient? Can we do that, have an efficient supply chain, and compensate workers fairly?
Yeah, there are a bunch of things we need to do. One thing we need to do is have antitrust enforcement, serious antitrust enforcement. I mean, your example about the eggs gets at a point I get at through beef in my book. There's a lot of engineered scarcity in this economy where, oh, you know, there's a shock to the system, and just somehow by accident, the industry that's disrupted ends up making record profits. You know, usually disruption turns into record profits for an industry that's got a monopoly power. So we need antitrust enforcement. We should welcome labor mobilization as an opportunity for workers to get their piece of the action, which will benefit the rest of us because we'll be dealing with human beings who are more motivated to continue doing their jobs. You know, I tell the story of Henry Ford in the book. He's not somebody to be lionized. He was a racist, yes, and anti-Semite. He crushed organized labor, but he knew a thing or two about making products at scale. And he specifically, you know, he doubled the wages of his workers in 1914. Some people called him a communist. He said, no, I just want people showing up who are undistracted, who can do their jobs. And I know that any business that's premised on low wage labor is inherently unstable. So we need antitrust enforcement. We need corporate boards to do their jobs and look past short-term incentives and think about the long-term health of companies. And we need labor to get a piece of the action.
Folks, that is Peter Goodman, my special guest today on Maggie and the Millionaires Talking Money. He is the New York Times global economics correspondent, author of two great books, Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, and his newest book, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. Yeah, Henry Ford, a despicable human being, but his ideas about paying people well, not just enough, but well, echoed repeatedly on the Maggie and the Millionaires by a number of CEOs that have run numerous different companies very successfully. They say the key to success, long-term success, is that motivated, happy, focused workforce. And to do that, you must pay people well so that they can live with some dignity. Thank you so much, Peter. I'm going to be buying your book and nerding out to it. I hope all of you do as well. I'd love to talk to you again, Peter. When we come back, I'm going to be joined by 8th Congressional District candidate, Dr. Kristen Lierley. She's going to be joining the vice president today at a rally in Green Bay. Keep it locked here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're an organ donor, right? Well, here's a tragic fact. Approximately 20 people die each day waiting for precious donated organs. You could make a life-saving decision simply by getting that important dot on your driver's license. That little dot shows those who need to know that you've made a decision to donate organs at a critical time. Go to heroicdeed.com to learn more about the importance of organ donation and how you can make your wishes known. Talk to your family. Get the dot. Save lives. HeroicDeed.com.
Let's go, girls.
What's up, y'all? Welcome, welcome back. If you're rejoining us, my name is Maggie Dawn. I'm host of the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network, joined by one of my most favorite guests. I'm so glad we're doing this every week, Dr. Lierley. She's Dr. Kristen Lierley, candidate for the 8th Congressional District, a fabulous OBGYN. And before we got on air, we were talking about the chaos of being in public service, of campaigning. I certainly can say during my days in public service, it was every day something was happening that kept me on my toes. There was never a dull moment. And certainly over the course of your career as an OBGYN and now as a candidate for Congress, you have experienced that in spades. You were sharing a story about what happened yesterday at work, Dr. Lierley.
Yeah, well, hello. And thanks for hanging out, because you're right, it is always such a blast to spend this. It feels like a little fun coffee clutch.
It does. And all of you get to participate with us.
Yeah. So anyway, yesterday at work, I was just doing my thing, seeing patients, and my nurse came running in and she said, emergency C-section, you have to go. And so I quickly said goodbye to my patient and I ran to the operating room and I delivered a baby really quickly and saved his life. I got him out in about a minute and his mom did great and everything was great, but it was not what I was expecting to do yesterday. But you know, this is what life is like right now. And then you add on top of that all the chaos of the campaign and how it fits in with the other campaigns. And I'm really super excited that I'm about to be on stage in a few minutes here with Kamala Harris.
Yes.
I mean, come on, my life is incredible. So yeah, I'll take the chaos any day if I know that I'm saving lives and making a difference. That's what matters to me.
Yeah, I've absolutely felt the same way when I worked in public service, that as crazy as it got and the late night phone calls and the early meetings, that it was good to do that work on behalf of the residents and taxpayers that I worked on behalf of. It was such a privilege. I so respect the work that you've spent your entire career doing and now are trying to do on behalf of all of the residents and voters and taxpayers in the 8th Congressional District. I'm so excited for you, Dr. Lyerly, that you get to be on stage with VP Harris. Tell her Maggie Dawn says hi. The interview invitation still stands. What are you expecting this afternoon at this rally?
I am getting so many texts from my friends all over Green Bay saying, I'll be there front and center. I'll be cheering for you. We can't wait. Green Bay is so excited to embrace Vice President Harris. And we have incredible local leaders who are going to be there as well. Shannon Holsey from the Stockbridge Muncie tribe, who is just a visionary woman and an incredible leader. Jim Ritterbush, who is a union stalwart up here. So to be able to stand there with all of these folks, I just couldn't be more honored or more excited. And also, I just want to say, you all might think Northeast Wisconsin is like in the sticks, we're old school, and in many ways we are, but this is the dawn of a new day up here. May I remind you that we have more women running for office as Democrats than men, and we also have a substantial number of folks from the LGBTQ community, so we are the gals, the gays, and a few good men up here running as Democrats, and man, we are having a blast.
I love it. The gals, the gays, and a few good men. That is all it should take to get good things done. I love it. Speaking of Northeastern Wisconsin, I'm pumped and really excited. Kristen Alfheim is going to join me tomorrow on the show. She's running up in Northeastern Wisconsin. Really excited about that. She's going to join me at 2:30. But I wanted to ask you, not just about the excitement level, but, you know, so much has happened in the last 2 days, Dr. Lyerly, from the presidential election on down. What was your reaction to hearing as a woman? I was simply stunned over the last 3 days to watch sort of the kid gloves with which Donald Trump was handled at the Economic Forum of Chicago. He was allowed to continue on and on and on and on in a non-responsive manner. Donald Trump then not just given kid gloves in a friendly interview in this pseudo town hall, the audience was basically a bunch of Republican MAGA plants asking him easy questions, while at the same time, Vice President Harris went into hostile territory and engaged basically in a debate with Bret Baier. And it just seems to me that there continues to be an absolutely absurd and obvious double standard. Have you seen that? Have you experienced that on the trail yourself?
What I'm mostly hearing on the trail is that people feel unheard. And that's what they want to talk about at the doors. They want to talk about how they are struggling to get by. Often people do talk about reproductive health concerns. They don't really talk about the top of the ticket. And here in Northeast Wisconsin, we were in Wittenberg earlier today. You know, there were some people who said, yeah, Trump, they're disgusted by him, but they still plan to vote for him. And until you start to have these conversations about what does this mean and how is he decompensating and what's going on with the media, we're all kind of locked into where we are. I mean, I've never seen this country like this before. I am 54 years old and I've been watching, and I have never seen us so locked into just one single person, the way that people are so dedicated to such a flawed human being, and they can't even really explain it themselves. So one of the things that I'm really enjoying is being out in some of these rural areas and just creating a space for people to have a conversation. Like I was at a sheep farmer's house today, and he was telling me about how Kamala Harris is a Democrat or is a communist. And it was so clear that we weren't going to be able to have that conversation, but he was still willing to talk to me about what I cared about, and he was still willing to put my sign up in his yard. So wow. Like where do you, every conversation is nuanced. Everybody's coming at it from a different angle with a different set of experiences. But you know, when it comes to Trump, it's just, you almost can't even bust through that because those opinions are so locked in.
Yeah, I think the stakes for people for changing their mind or being open to contrary information or a different viewpoint are just so high psychologically that I think it's put all sorts of obstacles in the way. And my concern has often been what you just expressed, Dr. Lyerly, that our entrenchment into our teams or into our camps is preventing the identification of what really matters to people every day for their families. And then the places where we have agreement and can actually reach a collaborative, cross-partisan or bipartisan policy solution to make everyday Wisconsinites and everyday 8th congressional district voters' lives better. And I'm so glad to hear that you're able to make those inroads. What's making you most excited about these last, what do we got, 19, 18 days left? Do you remain excited or is the gas tank starting to inch towards E?
Oh, I'm super excited. I just came off 10 straight days of 24-hour call at the hospital while I was doing campaign stuff. Now I just have to focus on campaign stuff. So my gas tank is full. We are going to be all over the district. Like I said, I was in Wittenberg today. Guess what? There are still independent voters out there. I had a great conversation with Nikki today, who was telling me how hard it was for her to get by. We actually interrupted her when we knocked on her door because she was trying to figure out which bill she was going to pay and which bills she wasn't going to be able to pay this month. And you know, people are struggling and there is room, but you've got to take the time to hear them and to respect them and to give them that space to talk. I think when we're afraid to have those conversations, when we're afraid of the conflict, because you know, conflict is real and you don't ever agree with everybody about everything. You don't agree with the person you love the most in the world about everything. So you've got to find that place where you can compromise. Life is all about where you can find that common ground. And I'm seeing it so much in these rural communities. We're focusing a lot on getting out to smaller towns, Little Suamico. We're going to be up in Sister Bay. We're going to be in Harrison. People have not heard from elected officials. When we knocked on Nikki's door, she said, I've never talked to anybody who is in public office or is ever running for public office because people don't go out there. Candidates haven't had to. You know, up here in Northeast Wisconsin, a third of the seats went unchallenged in the last cycle. So the people who hold those seats never had to respond to their constituents. It's a whole different ballgame this time around. We're fighting for it. We're listening to what people have to say, and people have a lot to say.
Yeah. First of all, when you're up in Sister Bay, please stop by Husby's for me and have a beer on my
Chad
behalf.
Oh, Chad is the best. Yes, for Husby's.
I'm a huge fan. I have passed many, many a unwise minute in Husby's as a college student. But I think, you know, that very kernel of how to find, again, the common ground and breakthrough, because genuinely, I have always thought that if you can get people to not talk about the top of the ticket or to not let the debates get sucked up by those narratives, which just so completely permeate all of our discussions, people, we agree that like there should be less money in politics. We agree that there should be a cap on CEO pay. We agree that there should be a living wage. If people are willing to work 40 or 50 hours of hard work every week, they should be able to live respectably. And with some freaking dignity, right? That those are commonly held values, especially in a place like Wisconsin, where hard work is part of the ephemera. It's in our genes or something. It's in the water along with fluoride, right? This is who we are. As you have these discussions with people and you talk to somebody like Nikki, what are some of the solutions that you're proposing to these very basic, every person, every Wisconsinite needs?
You know, everybody wants to talk to me about healthcare, whether it's reproductive healthcare or just healthcare in general. I work in a rural hospital. I talk to people who are struggling to even get to the doctor's office. You wouldn't believe the number of rides we have to arrange to get people in so they can get the care that they need. So people are really having a hard time accessing and affording healthcare here in the richest country on earth, where we have the most expensive healthcare system. We also, bankruptcy is most likely to come from a healthcare outcome. Yes, if you get sick, you are likely to not be able to pay for your bills and to go bankrupt. So, I mean, there are so many ways that we can improve healthcare. But, you know, it's the cost of things. Nikki was reminding me that just a few years ago, eggs cost less than a dollar. Remember that? Mm-hmm. Now milk is like $5 a gallon. She's struggling to pay her rent. She's paying over $600 for a studio apartment in Wittenberg. I mean, come on. How do you get by? And she's working her ass off. Yeah. So if people are just struggling, and we see the gap between the rich and the poor. She said to me, Kristen, if we could just go back to the 80s, I just think that would be so much better. And, you know, I'm always up for a good perm because that served me well in the 80s. But things have been getting worse since the 80s, and the divide has grown so stark between the haves and the have-nots. We've got to recreate the middle class. We've got to make housing affordable. We've got to make healthcare affordable. There are ways to do this, but we've got to find the political courage to do it. Yes. And we've got to elect the right people to make it happen. What's been happening in Congress these last couple of years has not worked. It hasn't worked. And it hasn't worked in Wisconsin either. Our legislature is a do-nothing legislature. Let's get some leaders in the right spot so they can do the right things on behalf of the people.
Well, and listen, I tell people all the time, a gerrymandered map is a map that creates the do-nothing legislature, the do-nothing Congress. That when you have fairly drawn maps, you by definition will create both elections and candidates and therefore elected officials that have to be responsive to your needs. If it is not a competitive district, why do they need to try? It is gerrymandering brings about extremism on both sides of the aisle. We've got to go, but very, very briefly, Kristen, can we get a little nugget of what you might be saying this afternoon with the vice president?
Oh, well, lots of good stuff. Talking about all the great things that she brings. There might be a little cheer at the end. I'm known for cheers and happiness. I know. Keep your eye out for that. But, you know, most of all, we are really trying to get people engaged, enthusiastic. There is a place at the table for every single one of us. This is the most consequential election of our lifetime. I know we say that every election, but this time, guys, it really is. So please get involved, sign up, do your part. That's what it's all about.
Thank you so much. That is Dr. Kristen Lierley, candidate for the 8th Congressional District, sharing the stage with Vice President Harris this afternoon in northeastern Wisconsin. Keep it locked. We've got Roderica Applewhite, White House spokesperson, talking about the Public Student Loan Forgiveness Program up next here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Welcome back, y'all. Welcome, if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We're at the last segment of the day. Boy, time flies when we're doing the work together, does it not? Very excited to be joined this afternoon for our last segment by Roderica Applewhite. She's a spokesperson for the White House. She's joining us today because quite an enormous milestone has been hit in the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. Roderica, welcome to the Maggie Dawn Show. Be sure you unmute yourself. Tell us about this enormous milestone and in the celebratory announcement that the Biden-Harris administration made this morning.
Yeah, absolutely, too. And thank you, Maggie, for having me on the show. So since President Biden and Vice President Harris took office in 2021, one of their main priorities was relieving student debt for Americans. It's something that saddles a lot of folks, me included, and also is a huge barrier to upward economic mobility for a lot of people. And so today we are really excited to announce that through our Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, that specifically relieves debt for or is a repayment program for teachers, police officers, firefighters who complete 10 years of service and then make payments for 10 years. We've announced that we are forgiving the rest of their debt for 60,000 additional public service workers. And this actually is helping us cross the 1 million person threshold as far as Americans that have been helped by this program in particular. That is a huge milestone for us. When the Biden-Harris administration started, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program has actually existed since 2007, but because of a lot of mismanagement and just, you know, really inefficiency, the program had only managed to actually work as intended for 7,000 people up until between 2007 and 2021. So this is huge. Millions of Americans have paid into this paying into this program. And so the fact that we're able to cancel another $4.7 billion in student loan debt for 60,000 Americans that qualify under this program is a huge milestone for us today. And it brings our total for student debt relief granted during the Biden-Harris administration to over $175 billion with a B dollars since taking office for just under 5 million Americans.
It's truly incredible. There's a couple of elements of the program, Roderica, that I want to emphasize. The Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program requires that your loans were financed through the federal government or are being currently financed. So you are borrowing from the federal government, in essence. And it also requires 10 years of consistent on-time payments of those student loans. And it requires 10 years of nearly consistent or continuous public service. There are some gaps that are permitted, but it's basically like you got to work in the public sector, giving back to your communities for at least 10 years, nearly consecutively. I'll just say this, as a lawyer that ran a large department and worked in government for many years, I know many of the people that worked with me that had only ever worked as public sector lawyers, whether that is district attorneys, guardians ad litem, public defenders, and then in the Corporation Counsel's office for Milwaukee County or the city attorney's office, had incredible debt because law school is so gosh darn expensive. This was an absolutely essential stepping stone for them to get past what was in many cases debilitating student loans, and they could only qualify, again, making those consistent payments and having, again, those 10 years of service. What do you want people to take away from hitting this milestone of debt relief for those that have given at least a decade of their lives to public service, hitting a million Americans that this has helped? It's an incentive, I think, to long-term public service, which I think should be applauded. But what do you think the administration wants people to take away from this milestone?
Yeah, absolutely. And I thank you, Maggie, for really laying out the facts of what this program does. I think something that, you know, anytime you see someone online talk about their debts being forgiven, and, you know, there's always somebody under the comments saying, oh, well, this is a handout, this is, you know, using my taxpayer dollars to do all this. No, I think to really beat back some of the misinformation around this, these are people who have paid into this program. They have effectively signed a contract saying, if I donate 10 years of my life to public service, to helping my community, then this is what this is the payback in return for doing that. And so this is a program they paid into. These are people who have been making payments for 10 years at a minimum. A lot of these people have been paying on interest and paying over, yes, their 10 years repeatedly. And so this is actually cleaning up a system. This is making it a lot easier for people to, one, want to go into public service, and also make sure that it's affordable to do so. And so this is a really huge point for us. The president was actually really happy to welcome a teacher from Boston who came to the White House, and he personally told her that, you know, the $46,000 that was still on her balance had been forgiven after she had been making payments for 12 years. And so this, wow, is something that is really, really important. I think, you know, part of my job is making sure that I message to Black Americans, specifically in my role at the White House. And so this is something that's also really, really big for Black Americans as well, especially since Black borrowers are more likely to take on student loans than their white peers, end up holding nearly twice as much debt, and owe more than they borrowed 4 years after graduation. So this is something that's really, really huge. It's equitable, and it really reflects the commitment and a promise made and kept by President Biden and Vice President Harris.
Thank you so much for your dedication and for being a great partner in getting the message out to every American about these sorts of programs designed to reward those who serve others with such dedication over a decade. That's Roderica Applewhite, spokesperson of the White House, celebrating a million people that have been helped by the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. That's going to do it for me, folks. Remember, I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me, but it is always better when we stand together. The Dominic Salvia Show is next here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.